You're listening to Engage with Andy Bush. To connect with the program today, please send an email to andrew.bush@comcast.net. That's andrew.bush@comcast.net. Now, back to this week's program.
Welcome back to a special energy edition of Engage. I'm your host, Andy Bush. We turn to the regulatory side of the energy markets with DC maven James Lussier of Capital Alpha Partners. Welcome, Jim.
Hello, Andy. It's always great to be on your show.
Thanks a lot. It's fantastic to have you on. You're one of the smartest, most plugged-in guys in Washington that I know. So let me ask you this. I mean, besides banking, the energy space appears to be the most targeted sector by Congress for regulation, from coal to LNG exports to fracking. I mean, energy draws a crowd. But Jim, you were just at this week, the Energy Information Administration's annual energy conference. Why don't you share with our audience what you heard and what you saw?
Well, the big focus at the EIA conference this year was exports, crude oil exports and refined product exports.
Right.
And also the massive quantities of oil and gas that America is producing now. EIA said that every year they run the numbers, every year for 5 years in a row now, the numbers come back higher. And the U.S. is definitely on its way to becoming the world's number one producer of oil, probably by a big margin, probably for a long time. And frankly, by some measures, we're the number one producer of oil already.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, also at that conference, were you surprised by the comments by the chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, Fred Upton, that the oil export ban that's in place now would not be lifted by the end of the year?
I wasn't surprised, really, but that's because I've studied great Western writers like St. Augustine, who said, Lord, make me chaste, but not yet. I think we've got an interesting situation here where the political class really hasn't understood yet what the resource story is, and they're a little scared about doing anything that might have to do with exporting crude oil, even though, in fact, the United States has treaty obligations under the WTO to export anything we have for sale to the general public here in America. We actually took the Chinese to court and sued them because they wouldn't sell their minerals to us. So it's a long-term unsustainable position to refuse to export what we're producing in large quantity. But there's this fear from politicians that if you do export oil, retail gasoline prices might go up. And so what we heard at EIA was a discussion of, number one, how much oil and gas is being produced.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, how world markets for refined product work, that gasoline is a global commodity with a global price. It's set on Brent, and that currently U.S. refiners, who get a very depressed price for U.S. domestic oil, are selling it on the world market for a relatively high global price for gasoline. So currently the refiners are capturing that spread, and the lower price for gasoline is not getting passed on to the public. So what this means is that refiners are kind of capturing a surplus there that's not helping consumers much.
Wow, that's really interesting. So, yeah, I mean, it's rents, as the economists would call it, right?
Well, it is. Now, you got to realize that, America, as you pointed out, is a nation that's losing its fiscal flexibility, and we've got huge problems with indebtedness. And,
mm-hmm.
Who am I to tell you, the currency guy, that there is eventually going to be a balance of payments crisis in the U.S.? And just in the past 2 years, from 2011 onward, refined petroleum has become one of the nation's top exports. It's still behind aviation and automobile parts and agriculture. But net exports of refined petroleum are now 8% of total U.S. net exports. And when you throw chemicals, mostly petrochemicals, in there, it's 16% of U.S. exports. So the oil story is really going to be fundamental to our long-term prosperity, mm-hmm. which is why we really need to focus on regulations that would shut down the oil industry. I mean, the big breakthrough at the conference, I think, was the sense that the oil is abundant, that actually Fred Upton's speech on oil was about an architecture of abundance.
Mm-hmm.
When President Obama was elected in 2008, we thought the country was running out of natural gas. We thought the country was running out of oil. And what we had to do was get beyond fossil fuel to clean, green, renewable energy and stuff like that. And, you know, we know how well that worked out.
Yeah.
But, you know, the reality is that oil and gas are a very big part of the economy now. They're contributing to domestic growth, depending on whose studies you believe. I mean, the White House, for instance, says that in the past 2 years, oil and gas production alone have contributed 20 basis points, that is 0.2% of GDP. IHS CIRA argues it's more like a full percentage point.
Wow.
But the bottom line, and of course that includes, you know, supply industries and so forth.
Right.
So, you know, it's clear that the one major thing that's working in the economy right now is oil and gas.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea that we need to shut down carbon-intensive industries, I think, is running square against the political reality that oil and gas, refined product, chemicals, very carbon-intensive industries are going to be at the center of the nation's economic growth and economic strategy and manufacturing strategy for quite some time.
Well, I think that's what's scary to some extent with the focus on energy and the regulation that's coming with it and that has been ongoing. Why don't you give me your top three areas of focus right now when it comes to energy and the regulations that are swirling around Washington, D.C.?
Well, it's all about carbon, 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 and
right.
The single biggest focus right now, in fact, the Obama administration has only one real focus now, and that is carbon regulation for the electricity sector.
Right, and that was part and parcel of the CO2 ruling that came out of EPA in the beginning of June.
That's correct, and so what this rule is attempting to do is to get us to a cap-and-trade system, but not quite a federal cap-and-trade system. It would be cap-and-trade at the state level under state law. And states could block together in regions like the REGI states, the Western Climate Initiative states, and set up their own carbon trading regime, or they could just put in big renewable mandates and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
They can shut down the coal-fired power plants. And actually, in the terms of the EPA's current regulation, you could actually build more gas, provided that it's very efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So the key thing to remember, though, is that in electricity, we can substitute fuels. We can go from coal to gas. We can have nukes, or we can try to keep nukes open, which runs contrary to the administration's past policy on Yucca Mountain. And, you know, it's possible that you can get wind energy if you can afford it. But the reality is that for some of these new hydrocarbon industries, I mean, the hydrocarbon is the product.
Right.
And so you really got to wonder, how does a regime that's going to transform the electricity sector, and may actually be doable to some extent because we now have so much gas to replace the coal.
Right.
You know, what happens during the next administration when the EPA next targets oil and gas production?
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. While we would love to have less CO2 in the air, we'd love to be able to make sure that we could produce electricity without generating that stuff. The fact is that the fossil fuels will remain for a long period of time critical for energy production. And one of the kind of the dirty secrets, literally, of the polar vortex last, you know, if I hate to bring that up to everybody who lives in the Midwest and in the East Coast, because that was really unpleasant. But the fact is that if you hadn't had the excess coal supplies that you had, you would have had rolling blackouts of electricity and power losses at a time where it was dangerously cold. So, I you know, everybody who's green, I totally get it, but really keep that in mind. You, at times, you really need this stuff to be available to burn. So I think that's important to keep in mind. I guess the question, Jim, then is, you know, as we have cheap energy, right, do you see, like, as we look into the midterm elections, and maybe this is a better place to go with this question, as
yeah.
you look into the midterm elections, if they if we see a changeover from the Senate, from Democrat to Republican, and a unified House with Republicans, how would that change the focus of regulation of the energy industry?
Well, I think a lot of regulations that could potentially be damaging are going to go on hold. The EPA.
Give me a couple of them.
Well, the carbon regulation probably can't be stopped at this point, but it can certainly be slowed down through oversight and congressional hearings. Hydraulic fracturing, to the extent that the administration is still working on hydraulic fracturing, I think that gets held over for the next administration. But more importantly, you can redefine the agenda. You can redefine what the issues are.
Right. I obviously, the Keystone Pipeline is a great example of a lot of people, a lot of union jobs that are getting held up by not having that pipeline and delaying that. And it creates a lot of problems with Canada. Of course, Canada, you know, I did a special on Canada a couple of weeks ago, and one of the things that's just happened there, obviously, is the approval of the Embry pipeline to the Far East, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's take a long time to get there, but eventually, if you delay the Keystone, they will build something to those other markets and delay it coming to the United States, which will be unfortunate, obviously.
Well, it would. I mean, I was astonished to see a study by one of the major Wall Street banks last year, which said that, sure, we have all these energy resources in America. Sure, the price of electricity is anywhere from one quarter to one half the price of electricity in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, indeed, it does seem clear that we have perhaps as much as $122 billion in new investment in petrochemicals come here.
Right.
That $122 billion number comes from University of Texas's Center for Energy and the Economy just last week.
Okay.
So
wow,
there's a potentially huge economic drivers here, and yet this report concludes that most of the non-energy-related manufacturing development is going to occur in Mexico, basically because we have environmental regulations that make it hard to build greenfield factories in the U.S., and also especially because of the U.S. corporate tax system. So.
Right, and just in full disclosure, ladies and gentlemen, Jim and I try to meet once a month at a place called the Center for Strategic Tax Reform, and Jim, I don't know how long you've been going to it. I've been going to it for 10 years, and just finally we're getting some movement forward on tax reform, but that's got to be one of the key things that is on everyone's mind for the potential changeover in Congress.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think we're really getting geared up for a major tax reform cycle. If you see the number of companies announcing corporate inversions
now, yeah,
you know, that sort of sends the signal that the tax code we've hated for so long is really beginning to fall apart in a global competitive environment.
Yeah.
So, I mean, going back to what you were asking about, Republican Senate, if that happens, the regulatory agenda going forward, economic policy agenda, I think the regulatory agenda is going to switch away from things like regulating carbon, regulating hydraulic fracturing, regulating ozone to try to figure out what is it that we've got to do to clear the field so that we can have economically rational development of these resources with appropriate environmental controls, but still taking advantage of this tremendous structural asset that we have in the U.S., which is not available to some of our major trading partners like Europe or, frankly, China.
That's a great point. James Lucier from Capital Alpha, always sounding rational in a sea of insanity in Washington, D.C. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Glad to do it, Ann.
Okay, man. All right. When we get back, I'll give you my final thoughts. This is Engage.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
What do business and sports have in common? Both are based on competition, and the goal of each is the same, to win. If you're in business, you need an edge over your competitors. You need to innovate and improve. You need to make adjustments to stay ahead of your competition. Tune in to The Business Locker Room with Kelly Riggs. Get the playbook and the coaching you need to improve your business performance. The Business Locker Room airs live every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel. Are you ready for what happens next? If you have your investments, retirement planning, and business plans all in a row, you're probably set. But are you really all that sure? Listen to In Black and Whites with host Peter Whites. Peter and his guests will cover business and investment topics that you need to know about right now, whether it's new technology, 401k plans, mergers and acquisitions. We're here to help you. In Black and Whites airs live Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on Voice America Business.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.